Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 183. It's Monday, October 17th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, I'm actually going to pass on the local COVID update. I have a couple COVID stories, but I think it actually gets in the way. First of all, the COVID surveillance is getting so weak and spotty. I mean, we're testing less and less. So the numbers are just not as solid as they should be. But really, just to make the point that this is the calm before the storm. We're entering flu season, and we have got an alphabet soup of variants that is heating up. Over the summer, I was really impressed by one variant taking over another, that one to receive another one. It really just passed the baton along for just this unending burn of over the summer, like a million infections a day. Now, that's tamped down a bit, and it's good news that hospitalizations are down quite a bit and deaths are down not nearly as much, which basically means that our most vulnerable populations are still getting nabbed by this virus. But now with this full complement of variants, and each one, of course, because it has to compete with increasingly greater immunity in the population, that you're getting this now a sweet kind of a full courts press of all the letters and numbers. And we don't know what's going to happen, but it is going to be very different. It's going to be weird and it's not going to be good. So boost up, people. And first up from MedPage today, younger kids can now boost up. FDA says young kids can now get Omicron boosters too. The FDA expanded the authorization for the bivalent COVID-19 vaccine boosters to include younger children as well as of last Wednesday. The Pfizer and Moderna's bivalent mRNA shots, which target the original COVID strain and the BA4 and BA5 Omicron subvariants, can be administered at least 2 months following completion of a primary series or prior booster vaccination. The updated emergency use authorization allow for the administration in children ages 5 and up in case of Pfizer's shot or 6 years and up for Moderna's shot. And for kids, old people, and other vulnerable folks, this from NBC News, flu off to an early start as CDC warns about potentially severe season. Reports of flu and other respiratory illnesses are higher than what would be normally seen in the U.S. at this time of year, according to the CDC. We've noted that flu activity is starting to increase across much of the country, especially in the southeast and south central U.S., said CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky. Typical flu seasons ramp up in December and usually peak in February. Most of these are influenza A, specifically the strain called H3N2. While any version of the flu can be dangerous in vulnerable populations, this strain has been known to cause more severe illness. It takes about 2 weeks after a flu vaccine injection to provide full protection. The CDC recommends everyone ages 6 and older get an annual flu shot. And it's more than just the flu. This from NPR. There's a spike in respiratory illness among children, and it's not just COVID or the flu. The United States is seeing a significant spike in respiratory illnesses among children. Sick kids are crowding emergency rooms in various parts of the country, and some pediatric hospitals say they are running out of beds. But this uptick in illness has largely been due to viruses other than the coronavirus, like RSV, enteroviruses, and rhinoviruses. While respiratory infections typically surge in the winter months, experts say that this year the season has started much sooner and that numbers are unusually high. Rates are as high as 25% of those who have tested positive for RSV. That is quite unusual for October. We would typically start to see higher rates in November, December, and January, said Dr. Ibukan Kalu, a specialist in pediatric infectious diseases at Duke Children's Hospital. Kalu said that while respiratory viruses like RSV can be severe in young infants, older children were also beginning to experience severe symptoms that require hospitalization to help them breathing. When combining with the fact that some children may already have underlying illnesses that require them to receive oxygen at home when they get viral infection, a hospital system already feeling the strain from the COVID pandemic is once again being slammed with demand for care. We've been strapped, and hospitals have sort of been functioning at the edge of how they can function. We're seeing more people requiring help and fewer beds available, largely due to staffing needs, explained Kalu. This combination is going to create more and more problems. Okay, well, next up, we have some really interesting polling data. This from The Hill. 4 in 10 Americans misrepresented COVID status, adherence to public health measures. Over 40% of United States residents misled others on either their COVID-19 vaccination status or how they followed public health guidelines, according to a new study. In a survey of over 1,700 U.S. adults conducted in December 2021, researchers found 42% of participants admitted to not adhering or misrepresenting how they were adhering to COVID-19 protocols. The survey findings were published this week in the American Journal of Medicine's online journal, JAMA Network Open. Out of respondents that admitted to misleading others related to COVID-19, about a quarter said they told someone they were taking more COVID-19 preventive measures than they were. Okay, so remember, this is a little over 40% of the people who said that they were misleading people. So when you have a quarter of that, that means 10% of the population told someone that they were taking more COVID-19 preventive measures than they were. Another 22% admitted to breaking COVID-19 quarantine rules. 21% said they avoided getting testing for COVID-19 when they thought they might have the virus. And 20% said they lied about knowing they had the virus when screened to enter a clinician's office. So again, this is 20% of that 42%. So almost 10% of Americans admit to lying that when they were going into a clinician's office where other sick and vulnerable people are, they lied about having COVID-19. Not a real great thing on the reputation of the United States as an honest and caring country. Okay, public health measures have the ability to dramatically reduce the spread and impact of a disease, researchers note, but their success depends on the public's willingness to be honest about and adherent to these measures. These data point out to us that a strategy that relies on people admitting to having symptoms or the actual diagnosis may not be the best strategy in future pandemics, said Angela Fagerlin, senior author of the study and chair of the Department of Population Health Sciences at the University of Utah Health. This data suggests many people will be dishonest for a variety of different reasons. Some of the most common reasons respondents reported for not adhering to COVID-19 protocols were because they, quote, wanted to fear normal or wanted to, quote, exercise personal freedom, according to the study. Others said they lied about following public health guidelines because they, quote, were following guidance from a public health figure I trust, like a politician, scientist, or celebrity. A smaller portion of survey respondents said they just, quote, didn't think COVID was real, or they, quote, didn't want someone to judge or think badly of me. Well, if you don't want people to think badly of you, don't lie regularly. Thank you, folks. Okay, well, some little better news in this mess that is COVID-19. This from The Hill. Vast majority of red state seniors have been vaccinated despite GOP vaccine resistance. For instance, nearly half of Oklahoma's overall population has declined the COVID-19 vaccine, yet more than 90% of seniors in the state have completed at least one round of inoculations, and almost two-thirds have received at least one booster. Both figures fall close to national averages. The same pattern plays out in other Republican-majority states. Public health data suggests red state resistance to COVID-19 vaccine is largely the province of the young. Seniors in the reddest states are inoculated and boosted at nearly the same rate as older Americans overall. The trends hold in Wyoming and West Virginia, North Dakota, Oklahoma, and Idaho, all states where large majorities of voters cast ballots for former President Trump in 2020. People who are old recognize that this was happening, particularly in the earliest stages of the pandemic, and they saw who was dying, said Susan Hassig, a professor of epidemiology at Tulane University in New Orleans. They saw their friends getting really, really sick. In Oklahoma City and its surrounding county, seniors have sought out the COVID-19 vaccine in waves, mirroring the peaks and valleys of the disease itself. 65% of seniors in Oklahoma County completed vaccinations by May 2021, in the first months when shots were available. By July, at the start of the Delta wave, 81% of older residents had been vaccinated. The rate climbed to 90% in December, early in the Omicron wave. A lot of right-leaning seniors realized that the risk of death and hospitalization was high enough that they weren't really willing to put politics over their health, said Aaron Wendelboe, a professor of epidemiology at the University of Oklahoma. So, good news, when reality hits, people actually do things to protect themselves. Okay, and of course, in this mess that is called the COVID-19 pandemic, we have long COVID. This from the Washington Post. We are in trouble. Study raises alarm about impacts of long COVID. A new long COVID study based on the experience of nearly 100,000 participants provides powerful evidence that many people do not fully recover months after being infected with the coronavirus. The Scottish study found that between 6 and 18 months after infection, 1 in 20 people had not recovered and 42% reported only partial recovery. There were some reassuring aspects to the results. People with asymptomatic infections are unlikely to suffer long-term effects, and vaccination appears to offer some protection from long COVID. It's one more well-conducted population-level study showing that we should be extremely concerned about the current numbers of acute infections, said David Petrino, director of rehabilitation innovation at the Mount Sinai Health System in New York. We are in trouble. Jill Pell, a professor of public health at the University of Glasgow, who led the research, emphasized that the study revealed the wide-ranging impact of long COVID on people's lives. There are lots of different impacts going beyond health to quality of life, employment, schooling, and the ability to look after yourself, she said. Okay, well, let's move beyond the COVID-19 stories, and here's something else from Associated Press. As suicides rise, U.S. military seeks to address mental health. According to Defense Department data, suicides among active duty service members increased by more than 40% between 2015 and 2020. The numbers jumped by 15% in 2020 alone. In longtime suicide hotspot postings such as Alaska, service members and their families contend with extreme isolation in a harsh climate. The suicide rate has doubled there. A 2021 study by the Cost of War Project concluded that since 9/11, four times as many service members and veterans have died by suicide as have perished in combat. The study detailed stress factors, particularly to military life, high exposure to trauma, mental, physical, moral, and sexual, stress and burnout, the influence of the military's hegemonic masculine culture, continued access to guns, and the difficulty of reintegrating into civilian life. The Pentagon did not respond to repeated requests for comment. But Secretary Austin has publicly acknowledged that the Pentagon's current mental health offerings, including a Defense Suicide Prevention Office established in 2011, have proven insufficient. Last year, the Army issued fresh guidelines to its commanders on how to handle mental health issues in the ranks, complete with briefing slides and a script. But daunting long-term challenges remain. Many soldiers fear the stigma of admitting to mental health issues within the internal military culture of self-sufficiency. And those who do seek help often find that stigma is not only real, but compounded by bureaucratic obstacles. And moving on to sexual violence, this from MedPage Today, sexual violence takes a toll on teens' mental health. Teenagers may bear the burden of poor mental health if they've had to deal with sexual assault or unwelcome sexual advances, UK researchers said. In a UK population-based study, sexual violence was linked with a slew of poor mental health outcomes among both teenage girls and boys, according to a study from University College London. Experiences of sexual violence were also tied to significant higher risk for other poor health, mental health outcomes, such as high psychological distress, self-harm, and attempted suicide. These models were fully adjusted for several potential confounders, including previous mental illness like depressive symptoms and self-harm up to age 14. When broke down by sexual violence type, youth who experienced sexual assault saw the worst psychological distress, but even experiences of unwelcome sexual approach without sexual assault took a toll on mental health, according to the authors. Our findings suggest sexual assault and harassment could be an important driver of the gender gap in mental health that emerges in adolescence. The researchers also called for better tailored and targeted support for victims to try to mitigate the potential long-term mental health impacts from sexual assault and harassment. And on that theme, but turning to the United States, this from ABC News, victims of sexual violence often left with overwhelming medical bills after emergency care. Sexual violence survivors may often face overwhelming medical bills when seeking emergency care, a factor that could discourage many people from seeking treatment, experts say. Survivors of sexual violence are charged nearly $4,000 in medical bills on average after seeking emergency care following an assault, according to a new recent study published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Only 1 in 5 victims of sexual violence seek medical care in the United States. The study's authors conclude that medical bills may deter victims from seeking treatment. People without health insurance pay, on average, over $3,600 out of pocket, while those with insurance still pay around 14% of total cost billed, an average of about $500. These bills may particularly burden low-income women and girls, disproportionately victims of sexual assault. In this post-Roe era, women are even less protected by the healthcare system when they experience sexual assault. As of September 2022, 11 states have banned abortion, including abortions of pregnancies that resulted from rape. Under laws that say that rape survivors need to prove that they got medical care to qualify for an exemption to get an abortion, that means you're asking the survivors to go to the emergency room, potentially incurring thousands of dollars of medical debt to access abortion. It's totally inhumane. The Violence Against Women Act is a federal law that pays for evidence gathering but leaves people responsible for additional bills associated with emergency care following an assault. Broadening provisions of the Violence Against Women's Act to include payment for other services, not just evidence collection, could help survivors avoid financial hardship and further trauma. And as well, the U.S. is experiencing a maternal health crisis. We have this from Stat News. Maternity care deserts on the rise across the U.S., report finds. A maternity care desert is defined by the March of Dimes as any county without a hospital or birth center offering obstetric care and without any obstetric providers. The latest report from the March of Dimes shows that the number of American counties categorized as deserts increased by 2% since the organization's 2020 report. Over a third of all counties are designated by the report as maternity care deserts, most of which are in rural areas. 7 million women across the country live in areas of limited or no access to maternity health care services. Every time a new report comes out, we seem to be going in the wrong direction, said Stacy Stewart, president and CEO of the March of Dimes. You're taking an already severe situation, and it's just getting worse. The U.S. is in a maternal care crisis, with the highest maternal mortality rate among comparable wealthy nations, one that continues to increase year over year. Black women in particular are 3 times more likely to die as a result of pregnancy than white women. In light of other stressors on the healthcare system, including the pandemic, staff shortages, and increased abortion restrictions across the country, experts worry that access to comprehensive reproductive care will continue to decrease, putting pregnant people and their babies even more at risk. The parameters of what qualifies as a maternity care desert are strict, according to Denise Jameson, Department Chair for Gynecology and Obstetrics at Emory University, who follows the March of Dimes work. For her, this means that the new data represent the tip of the iceberg when it comes to access. The report is certainly discouraging, Jameson said. For pregnant people, living in a maternity care desert is one of many compounding issues that may affect their experience and jeopardize their lives. Those who live in a maternity care desert are more likely to be poor, but they're also more likely to have asthma or hypertension, or to have been diagnosed with a substance use disorder, or have low access to telehealth, according to the new report. On top of that, maternity care deserts also appear to be found disproportionately in states that restrict abortion. Analysis from NPR using the 2020 March of Dimes report showed that states with strict abortion laws have a higher percentage of residents living in maternity care deserts. It seems ironic that you would both create a system where people were sometimes forced to remain pregnant and forced to give birth, and that in those very same places, there would be a disinvestment in the healthcare facilities to care for the people having babies, said Cindy Colin, a professor and vice chair of sociology at Ohio State University. But Colin and other experts say that the continued abortion restrictions go hand in hand with decreased access to obstetric care. Anything that reduces a person's ability to plan pregnancies adversely affects maternal health, Jameson said. One of the driving factors for decreased access is a simple one that residents of rural areas have noticed for years: hospital closures. In 2020, 19 rural hospitals closed. It's a continuation of a long-running trend. Since 2005, over 180 rural hospitals across the country have closed. The report cites physician shortages, low volumes of patients, and low-income communities as potential explanations for the closures. But Colin and her research collaborator Allison Norris, a co-founder of the Ohio Policy Evaluation Network, believes that closures that are a result of healthcare being treated like a business. Large hospital systems may not be willing to spend money on the high administrative costs of providing medical care in rural areas, and many mom-and-pop type providers just aren't able to. Ohio has the most women who have been impacted by reductions in access to care, over 97,000 per the new report. None of the patients or the providers are the ones who are making these choices. It's at a systemic level that they have no voice in, said Norris. The report proposes a number of policy solutions to improve access to care. It recommends expanding access to Medicaid based on income, as well as expanding the postpartum coverage period to a full year, as opposed to 60 days. Better integration of and access to midwifery and doula services, which can supplement physician care, and providing insurance coverage for telehealth maternity services. Though the report recognizes that poor broadband access limits how one may be able to access virtual appointments. The authors of the report urge lawmakers to pass the federal Black Maternal Health Momnibus Act.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of health care for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, next up, got a couple healthcare stories that delve into Medicare Advantage, which is the privatized Medicare programs that, frankly, are probably the biggest crisis in healthcare, for-profit healthcare that we have today. This from MedPage Today. The Medicare Advantage trade-off, saving money, losing access, although we don't actually save money with them. With beneficiaries rapidly joining Medicaid Advantage plans by the millions each year, more than half of those eligible will be in Medicaid Advantage plans rather than traditional Medicare as soon as next year. By 2032, that number is projected to hit 61%, according to a Kaiser Family Foundation analysis based on a Congressional Budget Office report. They are wooed by ads promising low or no-cost premiums, money added to their Social Security checks, free dentistry, home meals, prescriptions, and rides to the doctor. But those ads and marketing schemes don't tell the whole story. There's a greater and less well-publicized problem with Medicaid Advantage plans, denial of physicians' referrals for care. Even after appeals and approval, there are delays in scheduling. It's a game that gobbles up huge amounts of staff time, clinicians complain. One physician said he expects all Medicaid Advantage referral requests to be denied at least once. We hear about Medicaid Advantage policies that seem to purposely use all sorts of protocols to deny people care, or at least delay it, and we've seen more and more complaints, said David Wheel, program manager for the San Diego-based Health Insurance Counseling and Advocacy Program, a federally funded service that provides free, impartial insurance advice and education for Medicare beneficiaries. Even when services are finally approved, Wheel continued, some Medicaid Advantage beneficiaries go to schedule their test or procedure and find it's nearly impossible. The advertisements on TV are particularly misleading and worrisome, he said. featuring stars like Joe Namath, William Shatner, and Jimmy Walker. They urged beneficiaries to, quote, call the number on your screen, reassuring that it's free. We're seeing this all the time. People have been taken in by advertising that changes their Medicare benefits to a Medicare Advantage plan to the detriment of their medical outcomes, Wheel said. They can't see their doctors that they've been going to, and they have to work up all the tests and everything has to be redone with new providers. We continue to see clients who have been harmed by brokers who switch them to a plan that doesn't work for them. They just sign them up for the highest commission that will be paid. One government accountability office analysis conveyed concerns about the inordinate disenrollment of enrollees from Medicaid Advantage plans and into fee-for-service in their last year of life. The report raised questions about whether they were able to get timely, needy care before they die. Yeah, so take care of when their costs are low. When they have high costs, just dump them. Another report from the Office of the Inspector General in April found numerous examples of Medicaid Advantage plans denying or delaying approval for enrollees' recommended services, even though they were legitimately covered under Medicare benefits. We found that among the prior authorization requests that Medicare Advantage organizations denied, 13% met Medicare coverage rules. In other words, these services likely would have been approved for these beneficiaries under fee-for-service or traditional Medicare, the report said. Numerous beneficiaries told MedPage Today that they had signed up for their Medicaid Advantage plans when they were younger and healthier. Their premiums were zero or low, but after they needed care for newly diagnosed chronic conditions, they found themselves paying far more in co-pays and deductibles than a supplemental plan would have cost them. Now, with pre-existing conditions, they're ineligible to sign up for a supplement. They're stuck. Paul Speckert, MD, a San Diego endocrinologist, told MedPage Today that prior authorization, the ritual of applying for approval, being denied, and reapplying is a frustrating process he must endure for many of his patients, regardless of their coverage. But it's always worse when the patient has a Medicaid Advantage plan, he said. He tells these patients in or considering Medicare Advantage, that they're trading money for access that is low or no premiums for a limited network, and they may not be able to see the best specialist for their problem. I have to tell them, your plan does not offer that, he said. And I just have to add here again, editorially, overall, the cost of Medicaid Advantage is more expensive. It doesn't save money, even though it may save some money at some times for some beneficiaries. Back to the story. And there are longer delays in scheduling when contracted providers are backed up, creating a logjam for those waiting to be seen. A recent New York Times investigation quoted a former government official that estimated that Medicaid Advantage plans overbilled the government's Medicare funds as high as $25 billion in 2020 alone. Wendell Potter, former executive with two large health plan companies, Cigna and Humana, said on Democracy Now! That Medicaid Advantage plans, quote, will be recognized in years to come as the biggest heist, the biggest fraud, and the biggest transfer of wealth from taxpayers, middle income and low income, to corporate executives and shareholders. I'm going to read that again. Medicaid Advantage plans, quote, will be recognized in years to come as the biggest heist, the biggest fraud, and the biggest transfer of wealth from taxpayers, both middle income and low income Americans, to corporate executives and shareholders. Yikes. Okay, well, we're going to dive into a companion piece that drills down to one of the reasons why Medicare Advantage is so problematic. This from MedPage Today. Brokers earn more to steer new beneficiaries to Medicare Advantage. One reason why enrollment in Medicare Advantage plans has been growing as fast as it has, with 2.2 million new enrollees between 2021 and 2022, is the complicated broker commission structure. In a nutshell, because Center for Medicaid Services sets agents' Medicare Advantage commission rates, they tend to be much more favorable to those selling Medicaid Advantage plans to first-time enrollees than to agents who would put those beneficiaries in traditional Medicare with a supplemental plan known as a Medigap plan. That's a take from Christopher Westfall, an extremely vocal insurance broker who runs Senior Savings Network, who is licensed to sell health plans in 47 states. Westfall told MedPage Today that he's paid roughly twice as much in commissions, depending on the state and the plan, for enrolling a new beneficiary into a Medicare Advantage plan for 2023 compared with a Medigap plan. It's a huge financial incentive for agents to push nothing but the positive in Medicaid Advantage plans and leave out all of the potential negatives, Westfall said. Ironically, this is what all of the big call centers are recruiting for and selling, exclusively through their television commercials. Clients don't have to sign any disclosures, although he thinks they should be required to sign something that states the following. Quote, I understand I or my doctor is going to have to get prior authorization for procedures, and they may be denied altogether by the Advantage plan. I will have a limitation on my provider network. My doctor may change and leave my network anytime he wants, but I can't leave the Medicaid Advantage plan whenever I want, and I may forever give up my opportunity for a Medigap plan if I later want to go back to original Medicare. When the incentive is for agents to get clients off of traditional Medicare, none of those things are disclosed, he explained, and there's double the pay for me for the first year and paid all at once. Agents are always concerned about one thing, getting the first year Medicaid Advantage Commission, Medicare Advantage Commission, because it's paid all at once. When a health insurance agent enrolls a beneficiary, it's not just a one-time commission for that year, Westfall noted, as his sample commission schedule shows. Brokers reap payments for subsequent years if their client stays in the same plan, but the disparity between Medicare Advantage and supplemental plan commissions is evident here as well. Although rates vary depending on the region and the plan, a common commission for each renewing Medicare Advantage enrollee is about $375 per year, which continues annually as long as the beneficiary stays in that plan, Westfall explained. The renewal commission for each Medigap plan enrollee is a percentage of the enrollee's premium, usually around 22 to 26%, but that drops after the sixth year to 1 or 2% and zero after the 10th policy year. An agent, consciously or unconsciously, may pivot the client to a plan that brings back a revenue stream that will continue at a healthy pace as long as the client stays in the same plan. Commission rates for Medigap plans also drop precipitously for clients above age 80, from 22% to 11% within the initial 6 years for California, further disincentivizing brokers to enroll older beneficiaries. Westfall pointed out that if an unhappy enrollee wants to switch to traditional Medicare with a supplemental plan after the first 12 months of being in a Medicare Advantage plan, plans in all but four states are allowed to reject high-risk, unhealthy would-be transfers. This means that beneficiaries who have had common conditions or illnesses, including knee replacement, diabetes, cancer, or even high cholesterol and high blood pressure with other conditions will likely be rejected after answering a health questionnaire, a process called underwriting. Whenever they go with a Medicare Advantage plan, they forgo their opportunity, possibly forever, to go back to original Medicare with a supplemental plan that they could have had with no health question screening when they were new to Medicare, he explained. Yikes. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM, Toledo. This is We Act Radio. This is Just for the Health of It in the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, next up, we got a story that, of course, money matters, but it's usually better in the hands of people than large corporations. This from Medical Express. Bold new income strategy could help tackle mental health crisis among young people. Researchers at the University of York played a key role in a major new study which suggests that universal basic income could help reverse the epidemic of mental health problems among young people in the UK. Soaring living costs are causing unprecedented pressure on UK households, resulting in a dramatic increase in the number of people suffering from mental health conditions such as anxiety and depression, particularly among 16 to 24-year-olds. Under the Universal Basic Income Scheme, every UK citizen would receive regular payments to support their basic needs and provide them with a level of financial security. This addresses a frequent criticism of the existing welfare system, that it does not support those who are aspirational, hardworking, and responsible. The research reveals that universal basic income is economically feasible, that it can prevent or delay a wide range of health conditions, and that it is particularly effective in mitigating the mental health pandemic among young people. Okay, well, next up, going to switch gears and look at a story about the interface between commerce and healthcare, and this specifically is regarding grocery change. This is from a report called Superbugs in Stock. The first of its kind report, Superbugs in Stock, ranks the top 12 U.S. grocery chains and their subsidiaries on their policies and actions related to eliminating routine antibiotic use in their meat and poultry supply chains. The report demonstrates that the grocery sector has, to date, taken little action to protect the health of their customers, ensure the welfare of animals on supplying farms, or promote more sustainable food systems. Most grocery companies lack any meaningful policies requiring their meat and poultry suppliers to eliminate the overuse of antibiotics, despite the urgent need to protect human and animal health. And for those in our region, Kroger, Aldi, and Walmart received an F grade. And the only ones that were passing, but barely, Meijer and Costco got a D. Not very well. And I might add that these only looked at the private label or store-owned meat products. So that means even the ones that they have more direct control over, they're not controlling, and doesn't even get to the fact that the other meat products that aren't under their more direct control are not being regulated as well, taking responsibility for avoiding over-antibiotic use. Okay, well, let's switch gears again, go to a story that, while things may seem bad here, just have to look globally for things to look worse, unfortunately. This from Medical Express. Less than half of people over 50, age 50, worldwide, have received glasses or contact lenses needed to correct refractive error. New research published in The Lancet Global Health reveals that less than half of the people over age 50 worldwide have received glasses or contact lenses needed to correct refractive error, the world's most common visual complaint. This work informs a major World Health Organization report on eye care. Uncorrected refractive error refers to visual conditions such as presbyopia, myopia, hyperopia, and astigmatism that can be treated with simple interventions such as glasses or contact lenses. It is the leading cause of moderate and severe distance vision impairment worldwide, affecting at least 157 million people in 2020. The research found that while adequate treatment coverage for distance refractive error had increased by 19% since 2000, only 43% of all adults over the age of 50 were receiving simple treatments for these conditions, with a number at 21% coverage for those with problems of nearsightedness. Treatment coverage for distance refractive error varied worldwide, from 79% in the defined, quote, high-income region, including countries such as the United States, to under 6% in sub-Saharan Africa. The studies also highlighted a gender gap in all defined regions of the world, with lower levels of coverage in women. The World Health Organization aims to increase the treatment coverage for distance refractive error by 40 percentage points by 2030. In the launch of the first WHO report of the 2030 targets of effective coverage for eye care. Okay, a new area setting targets going to work on. Very bold. Let's hope it works. Okay, well, let's switch gears again and do a series of stories on toxic chemicals. First up from The Hill. 200 million pounds of toxic chemicals dumped into U.S. waterways in 2020, says analysis. Polluters in just 10 states were responsible for more than half of the 194 million pounds of contaminants released into U.S. waterways in 2020, a new report has found. Toxic discharge flowed into one of every three local watersheds across the country and included many cancer-linked chemicals, according to the findings, published 3 weeks ahead of the Clean Water Act's 50th anniversary. America's waterways should be clean for swimming, fishing, providing drinking water, and supporting wildlife, report co-author John Rumpler, the senior director of the Environment America Research and Policy Center's Clean Water Program, said in a statement. But all too often, polluters are allowed to use rivers as open sewers, added Rumpler, whose organization released a report together with the U.S. Public Interest Research Group Education Fund. The report's findings are based on data from the Environmental Protection Agency's Toxic Release Inventory, which includes surface water discharges self-reported by polluters. As the Clean Water Act turns 50, it's time to turn the tide on this toxic pollution, Rumpler said. Rumpler and his colleagues found that such contamination is heavily concentrated in 10 states, which collectively account for more than half of toxic substances by weight that flow into the country's rivers and streams. The top offenders include Texas, Indiana, Virginia, Louisiana, Alabama, North Carolina, Mississippi, our own Ohio, Kentucky, and Illinois, according to the report. Of the nation's major watershed, the Ohio River Basin received the largest volume of toxic discharge by weight in 2020, followed by the South Atlantic Gulf and the Mid-Atlantic, the authors found. Sorting chemical releases according to toxicity levels rather than by weight, Wisconsin, Texas, Virginia landed in the top offending spots. The Ohio River, the Great Lakes, and the Texas Gulf were the most toxic watersheds. Facilities dumped more than 1 million pounds of cancer-causing chemicals, such as arsenic, chromium, and benzene, into the country's waterways. The Austin Oyster watershed in Texas received the biggest volume of carcinogens. More than 200,000 pounds of chemicals that potentially cause reproductive issues were discharged in 2020, with Texas, Indiana, and Pennsylvania faring the worst in that category. Nitrates, which are linked to health risks and contribute to dead zones and toxic algal outbreaks, were responsible for more than 90% of toxic releases to waterways by weight, according to the report. Among the country's most significant sources of nitrate pollution are slaughterhouses and meat processing plants. When ranking sites by toxicity level rather than by weight, the authors found that the top polluting sites including mining and metal manufacturers, chemical plants, and power plants. Warning that their findings may be just the tip of the iceberg, the authors stress that the toxics release inventory does not include pollution from runoff, oil and gas extraction, or cancer-linked forever chemicals. A half century after the Clean Water Act took effect, it's outrageous that our children aren't guaranteed a toxic-free future, co-author Matt Cassell, director of the U.S. PERG Environment Education's Funds Environment Campaign. Moving forward, the researchers recommended that policymakers update pollution control standards in order to dramatically reduce toxic releases into the country's waterways. Other suggestions focused on restricting the use of toxic chemicals in product manufacturing, as well as situating chemical storage facilities at a distance from waterways. The authors acknowledge that some of their recommendations are already gaining traction, including calls for strengthening pollution controls in slaughterhouses. Meanwhile, their researchers added several states have restricted the use of forever chemicals and other toxins. Polluters too often recklessly dispose of chemicals linked to cancer, developmental harm to children, and reproductive damage, Cassell said. It's time to stop this toxic dumping. And in another source of toxic pollutants, this is from the Allegheny Front. Group finds PFAS forever chemicals used in Ohio oil and gas wells. A nonprofit research group has found that the oil and gas industry in Ohio has used PFAS, known as forever chemicals, in at least 101 oil and gas wells since 2013. Physicians for Social Responsibility released a report and said that the state's disclosure rules prevent the public from knowing how widely PFAS has been used. PFAS are known as forever chemicals because they don't break down easily in the environment. They've been linked to some cancers, reduced fertility, and developmental effects in children. However, the number of definitively identified cases of PFAS use may significantly underrepresent the use and presence of PFAS in the state associated with oil and gas operations, according to the report. PFAS are difficult to track because Ohio rules allow companies to claim, quote, trade secrets to avoid disclosure of chemicals they use. Between 2013 and 2022, oil and gas companies withheld the identity of at least one trade secret chemical in more than 2,100 oil and gas wells. PFAS chemicals are known to move quickly in water. Ohio accepts frack wastewater from Pennsylvania and other states. Hydraulic fracturing, the process used by many oil and gas well operators, uses millions of gallons of water mixed with chemicals to frack a well. The process brings up millions of gallons of chemical-laden wastewater. In Ohio, much of the wastewater is pumped into underground injection disposal wells. The state has 245 frack waste injection wells, according to analysis by Frack Tracker Alliance, referenced in the Physician for Social Responsibility's report, which accepted a total of 12.7 billion gallons of waste in 2020 from Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia. There could be PFAS in the wastewater that comes up from these wells, whether in Ohio or from neighboring states like Pennsylvania and West Virginia, and then is sent to Ohio for disposal. Ah, yes, the region's dumping ground. Welcome to Ohio. Fortunately, Americans are very concerned about the reckless use of harmful chemicals. This from The Hill. Voters want more protection from harmful chemicals, says poll. Most American voters say they want more government and industry protection from toxic chemicals, a new poll has found. Not only do the 1,200 respondents to the survey overwhelmingly want assurances that consumer products are free from harmful chemicals, but they're also willing to pay more for that reassurance. In the poll, commissioned by the University of California, San Francisco Program on Reproductive Health and the Environment, 92% of voters agreed that the government should require products to be proven safe before reaching the market, while 63% strongly agreed. People assume that what they buy is safe, and that almost always isn't the case, Tracy Woodruff, director of the Reproductive Health Program, professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive sciences, said in a statement. The good news is that this survey reveals overwhelming support for the government to do a better job of protecting people from harmful chemicals. Similar to the responses regarding government responsibility, about 93% of voters surveyed agreed, and 62% strongly agreed, that companies should do a better job of removing harmful chemicals from consumer products. About 88% agreed that companies should do a better job eliminating plastic and plastic packaging from these items, a survey found. At a time when most issues are politically polarized, the issue of keeping people safe from harmful chemicals finds widespread agreement among Democrats, Republicans, and independent voters, Celinda Lake, president of Lake Research Partners, said in a statement. About 76% of respondents expressed concern about the impact chemicals and plastics have on climate change, while 54% said that chemical regulations are not strong enough. Some 89% of voters surveyed expressed support for harnessing the Toxic Substance Control Act to make it easier to ban or limit harmful chemicals. Meanwhile, 56% conveyed strong support for such action. Asked whether it is important to remove harmful chemicals from the areas in which people live, work, and learn, 93% of respondents agreed and 57% strongly agreed, even if doing so would raise the cost of some products. Let's make it so. Okay, well, next up, we have another EPA action that's helping reduce pollutants in the environment. This from Reuters. U.S. EPA proposes to declare aviation lead emissions public health danger. The U.S. EPA said it is proposing to declare emissions from piston engine aircraft operating on leaded fuel as posing a danger to public health. Emissions from the 190,000 U.S. general aviation airplanes operating on leaded fuel accounted for about 70% of the lead entering the atmosphere, according to U.S. government estimates. Lead is not in jet fuel, which is used in commercial aircraft. While levels of airborne lead in the United States have declined 99% since 1980, piston engine aircraft are the largest remaining source of lead emissions into the air. Children's exposure to lead can cause irreversible and lifelong health effects, the EPA said. The majority of aircraft that operate on leaded aviation gasoline are small piston engine aircraft that typically carry 2 to 10 passengers. The Federal Aviation Administration in February announced a new initiative outlining how to safely eliminate the use of leaded aviation fuel by the end of 2030 without adversely affecting the existing piston engine fleet. Way to go, EPA. Okay, well, I want to close my regular reporting with another good news story from a regulatory agency, this from Associated Press. The National Transportation Safety Board wants all new vehicles to check drivers for alcohol use. The National Transportation Safety Board is recommending that all new vehicles in the U.S. be equipped with blood alcohol monitoring systems that can stop an intoxicated person from driving. The recommendation, if enacted by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, could reduce the number of alcohol-related crashes, one of the biggest causes of highway deaths in the U.S. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration said that roadway deaths in the U.S. are at crisis levels. Nearly 43,000 people were killed last year, the greatest number in 16 years, as Americans returned to roads after pandemic stay-at-home orders. Once the technology is ready, it will take years for it to be in most of the roughly 280 million vehicles on U.S. roads. Until last year's bipartisan infrastructure law, Congress required the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration to make automakers install alcohol monitoring systems within 3 years. The agency can seek an extension. In the past, it has been slow to enact such requirements. The legislation doesn't specify the technology, only that it must passively monitor a driver to determine if they are impaired. In 2020, the most recent figures available, over 11,600 people died in alcohol-related crashes. That's about 30% of all U.S. traffic deaths and a 14% increase over 2019 figures, the last full year before the coronavirus pandemic. All right, well, there's a technological solution that could prevent a lot of alcohol-related traffic deaths. Okay, bum, 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 bum. We're at the section of the program where you can get bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use, and long reads for increase enrichment, all available online, just like each of the stories I reported on in this episode. I'll give a link at the end of the list. There are 22 bonus articles this week. First up, number one, the next U.S. COVID wave is coming. While it will be, quote, much weirder than before. Two, messaging, the unrecognized coefficient in pandemic control matters. Messaging matters. Keep talking about COVID. In this instance, it's a good example in public health. I think with COVID that our leadership, national, federal leadership, such as President Biden, have pretty much, and the CDC, have kind of given up on really talking about COVID that much. They've kind of just fell into the COVID's over kind of feeling that most of the country has, which is not exactly qualify as leading. So one of the messaging, reason why messaging matters is you need to keep talking about things that matter, like COVID, which is still killing almost 400 people a day. Okay, bonus article number three. It still prevented cancers. Experts discuss furor over colonoscopy screening study and dissect the nuances. So I'm only including this because I didn't report on this because it doesn't really offer a lot of changes that you need to know about. But there was a big study out that raised a lot of concern about maybe questioning the value of colonoscopy. But the bottom line is getting a colonoscopy is still a good way to prevent colon cancer. Although you can do the less invasive than colonoscopy, but colonoscopy works just fine. Four, how health systems can truly value black lives. Help close the racial wealth gap. So this is an article specifically getting at how hospitals can do their part in closing the racial wealth gap and reduce health disparities. Five, EPA cites racial discrimination and disparities in Louisiana's Cancer Alley. So this is one of the highest cancer rates in a region is in this Louisiana's Cancer Alley. And I've reported on that before. But this is breaking new ground because the EPA has sent letters to specific state departments in Louisiana and has basically cited and accused them of racial discrimination and saying that this is violation of federal law. New ground being broken in the fight for environmental justice. Okay, article number six. South Dakota signals the end of an era on Medicaid expansion by voters. So there's been a slow increase in Medicaid expansion of states. It was around 15 or so that were not originally included in the Medicaid expansion when the Supreme Court ruled that the ACA Obamacare could not force Medicaid expansion on states. But South Dakota looks like it's ready to pass based on a voter initiative to have Medicaid in South Dakota, but the rest of the states that haven't expanded Medicaid expansion do not have good ways for voters to get initiatives on the ballot. So it'll be up to legislators, but it's getting, fortunately, a smaller number of people. I think it's still 11 states. Article number seven, baby, that bill is high. Private equity gambit squeezes excessive ER charges from routine births by setting up billable maternity ERs at the point of delivery. So somebody coming in looking at delivering a baby probably wouldn't even know that they're in this maternity ER. They show up, but it's actually because ERs can bill at much higher rates. These private equity firms who own these healthcare companies set it up so they can bill ER rates, even though the ER might only be separated by a line on the floor or a curtain. Article 8, maternity care in the U.S. is in crisis. It's time to call the midwife. So instead of figuring out ways to charge more for maternal care, we should have good care that can be delivered inexpensively, and that's called midwives. Bonus article number 9, adult hospital beds are more lucrative than children's beds. So hospitals are closing children's units, creating shortages. So this was happening before, but it got accelerated by COVID because when COVID was pushing them hospitals to the edge, and because COVID affected adults much more than kids, a lot of adult children's units were converted to adult units. And because this is more profitable, hospitals are reluctant to go back. So they're creating more and more shortages for kids' care in hospitals. Bonus article number 10. New generation of weight loss medications offer promise. I've actually been very reluctant to really report on this because these are decent drugs. They work pretty well, but they're also hugely expensive, like $12,000 or $13,000 a year. And when you look at the cost effectiveness, they're actually about double at least of what would be considered cost effective. So they work, but they're at a huge price. 11, spread of Catholic hospitals limits reproductive care across the U.S. I've reported on this before, is that a lot of people don't even know that they're in a Catholic-owned hospital, and that can limit their reproductive care. Sometimes it's too late when you're already in the hospital. 12, the lucrative troubled teen industry often uses ineffective and punishing treatments. So there's a lot of these kind of boutique treatment things that are really expensive, but they're not actually very individualized treatment and often use punishment as a way to treat mental health, which is not very effective. Bonus article number 13, a new frontier for hearing aids. Over-the-counter hearing aids are coming at long last, but lower prices and greater accessibility may take time to materialize. So the FDA did allow for over-the-counter hearing aids, but it's going to take a while for, quote, the marketplace to adjust to this new reality. But it's worth investigating if you or someone you know is interested in hearing aids and can't afford the usual route, which can cost thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. 14. The first malaria vaccine is here. Let's meet the moment. So I've reported on this new malaria vaccine, which takes four doses, and it's only a modest efficacy, but it's very cost-effective. But it seems like the international health community is kind of balking about whether it wants to go all in on this. And to meet the moment means doing things that are cost-effective. Article 15, it's a bleak world day of the girl due to the pandemic, but no one's giving up hope. So this is a World Health Organization declaration of the day of the girl, which has made progress of girls and young women in recent years and decades, but the pandemic has sent that backwards, but no one's giving up hope. Bonus Article 16, economic and social pain is a commonality across drug crises, and this must be healed to end the vicious cycles of addiction. So people are all, you know, we've gone up and down, you know, my whole adult life, you know, you see it, one drug becomes really popular, it goes up, it goes down. But the thing that connects this is economic and social pain. And if you're not dealing with these underlying conditions, you're going to see the vicious cycle of addiction continue. 17, getting some more deep reads here. Do you matter to others? The answer could predict your mental health. So we've all heard, of course, of the Black Lives Matter movement, which, of course, is predicated on the notion that all people should matter. And if you want all people's lives to matter, that black lives should matter. You send the fire truck to where there's the fire. You don't just throw water on every single house. So that's a good background deep read on why mattering matters. Wow, like that. We should have to even discuss that. But bonus Article 18, how gaslighting manipulates reality. Gaslighting isn't just between people in a relationship. It involves social power too. So gaslighting is something that is a social and political force that needs to be reckoned with. And part of the realization I've had with COVID-19 and public health is that virtually any public health issue, because it often involves relatively small effects over tens or hundreds of millions of people, that if people want to gaslight it, it seems to make sense to not worry about it, which fits into people's kind of lazy psychology. Okay, and for a complete change of pace, bonus article number 19, why the Pentagon is the world's biggest single greenhouse gas emitter. I've reported on that before, but this is a good backgrounder and reminder. And if you don't believe in superpowers, next up, bonus article number 20, a super smeller can detect the scent of Parkinson's. That's a human being, not a dog, leading to an experimental test for the illness. Very cool. 21, keep it or toss it. Best before labels cause confusion. Getting a little more in your cupboard there. Probably the best summary of that is if in doubt, you probably don't need to throw it out. And lastly, 22, how to know if it's depression or just normal sadness. It's okay for my show to make you normally sad. I hope it doesn't make you depressed. Thank you for spending this hour with me. My second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.